My talk is called Self-Compassion for the Sake of All Beings. Self-Compassion for the Sake of All Beings. And it's quite a personal talk, and I'm hoping that it joins up nicely with Pavarabodhi's talk from yesterday. The only thing is that I'm slightly guessing because, of course, I didn't understand all her talk yesterday because it was in Swedish, but I understood a lot of it. So anyway, I'll leave you to judge whether it lines up nicely. I've been a Buddhist for 23 years since I became a Mitra in West London, and I've been ordained for 13 years. And throughout all that time, in certain situations in my life, very specific situations, I've suffered from really acute distress in relation to particular aspects of my life. And it was so bad that at its worst, sometimes I would just find myself being sick, you know, vomiting and sweating or running off to the toilet suddenly. And my mind just racing. As I try to think my way out of my problems. And all that happened was it just got worse and worse. And it went on for years, on and off. And it didn't ruin my life. I was still able to have a creative and full and interesting life and do lots of, be very capable in other ways, because it was very specific. But there was this consistent thread of acute distress running through it all. And I had years and years and years, I mean, really years of talking therapy. It didn't help at all. It helped with other things, but not with that. And I'm laughing, but of course it wasn't funny. And then I tried to be a good Buddhist and just practice mindfulness in response to it, and just watch it. And that didn't really work, because I would still keep on trying to figure out what it was. Thinking about the things. And thinking it was to do with the actual issues that I was upset about. So I'd think my way through these issues. And I just got more and more distressed and confused. And one day I met a psychologist on retreat. And this psychologist watched me doing my thing over a few days and weeks, and one day said, look, this is anxiety. This is a clinical condition called anxiety, and it's not hard to treat. So this was rather hopeful. And what I was being told was that it wasn't the problems themselves that were the problem. It was what my brain was doing in response to the problem. So I went to my doctor. And I said, please help me. And the doctor was completely unhelpful. But after a very long time, I got a therapist. But you do have to wait a very long time if you want a free therapist in Britain. And meanwhile, I was told about a book called The Compassionate Mind. I've written it on here. I'll show it to you later. You can write it down later. I don't know if it's been translated into Swedish yet. I suspect not. Do you think so? No. So there are two books you could try. One is called The Compassionate Mind, and that's if you're very confident in English and you actually like reading a long book by a somewhat eccentric South African psychologist who lives in Britain, who likes red wine and cricket, and talks about it, you could read that. If you want something slightly more, shorter and methodical, more like a self-help book, you could read another book which I've written on here, which is called Mindful Compassion. So Paul Gilbert is a British psychologist who's developed a system of psychological treatment which provides a simple model for understanding the way the brain works, what it does when it's stressed, and how to address this. And what's lovely is that he's based it explicitly on Buddhist principles about compassion. And altruism, compassion for self and compassion for others, and the difference this could make to the entire world if we were all practicing it. So eventually I did actually get to see the therapist who was training in this particular kind of therapy, compassion focused therapy with Paul Gilbert himself. And that was very, very helpful. But meanwhile, I'd actually read his book, and I reckon I'd probably done half the work just from reading the book. So I only had 25 weeks of free therapy, and I read the book, and it was enormously helpful. I must be at least 75% less anxious than I was when I started. So I hope that's makes you feel very very hopeful if you suffer from anything like this. So you probably think, well, what did she learn? Okay, so here's what I learned. I learned that we have this amazing, huge brain, the human being, which has evolved over millions of years in ways that are not completely helpful. It's brilliant in many cases, but it's really not brilliant in this particular case. Paul Gilbert calls it the tricky brain. Tricky brain. It plays tricks on you. It's difficult. It's a bit annoying. And what happens is when this brain gets triggered by something it finds frightening, it becomes very unsophisticated. So if you're trying, you know, if you imagine trying to do a very intricate, detailed piece of woodwork, like making a picture frame, perhaps, you need a very tiny hammer, you know, or a very tiny screwdriver. Yeah. Well, you know the kind of hammer that you put up tents with? You know, really huge. It's called a mallet in English. If you use that, you're going to get a very nasty piece of woodwork. And this is what happens with your brain. The oldest part of the brain, which Pavra Bodhi referred to yesterday, it just says, run away! Run away, drop everything and run away. It's concerned only with survival. And at that point, the newest, most subtle and sophisticated part of your brain just switches off, because you don't need that when you're just trying to survive. So you stop thinking creatively and you completely lose perspective. Your brain, in a way, becomes a bit like a very, very special, specially unhelpful kind of magnifying glass. You know what a magnifying glass is? Something you know, used to make things, to read something bigger. This special kind of magnifying glass only sees horrible, bad, dangerous things and then makes them really big. And so imagine trying to deal with your problems using this special kind of magnifying glass that only sees bad things, makes them much bigger. And you have to do this. You have to do this whilst wearing boxing gloves. No. Huge boxing gloves. So the result is a huge emotional and physical mess. So it's essential to stop at this point. You've noticed yourself getting into this horrible state of mind. Maybe because you notice you have pain in your body, or some awful memory is coming back again, or something that particularly distresses you is happening. It's essential to stop, notice what's happening, and calm your poor, distressed little brain down. Poor little thing, stakar. Poor little thing. And you do that by showing kindness, showing self-kindness. And there are lots of ways of doing that. Pavra Bodhi's been showing us when we do our compassion exercises. The two books I've told you about, describe them at quite some length. So that's the kind of emergency treatment, you could say, in the moment. But you can also, of course, just generally in life and in your meditation practice, cultivate self-compassion as just a general positive emotional habit for the whole of your life. And of course, the more you do this, it will also spill out into your relationships with others, your responses to others. So it sounds selfish, but it isn't selfish. The more we take care of ourselves in this, with this larger perspective as well, the more it will spill out into the world. If you're not sure that you believe me, you don't have to just because it's me and I'm sitting here in the kesa. Just try it and see for yourself what the effect is. So I started to do this, and I found that it really worked. First of all, it was helpful to learn that the situation was not as hopeless as I had assumed. That in itself was a big start, a very important first step. And I found that, I mean, I've been practicing mindfulness for 20 years, so I could notice the moments when I was about to try solving my problems with my huge magnifying glass and my boxing gloves, and I began to learn that with compassion I could kindly remind myself that this wouldn't lead anywhere useful, and that I could cultivate a warm and friendly response to my suffering, which would calm my brain so that it worked better for me. One of the really good things that Pavarabodhi referred to yesterday was that, as she said, the brain actually can't tell the difference between something that's actually happening and something you've just imagined. It can get freaked out by an imaginary thing as much as a real thing. And if that's the case, it can also be helped by imagining something wonderful. So, for example, this was quite funny. I was on a solitary retreat in a little tiny cabin up the hill from Dána Cóiseáil, which is a retreat centre in Scotland. And it's extremely beautiful, so I recommend that you go there. I got into a horrible state of mind on this solitary retreat. It was so bad, I was so anxious. I really didn't think I could stay there. I could not imagine sitting in that little cabin for another 2 weeks in this awful state of mind. And I thought, what should I do? I thought, I'm going to have to phone a friend. I can't stay. I'm going to have to go and find a phone and phone my friend. So I thought, who is my good friend who I know will be compassionate and kind to me? This is long before I discovered this compassion idea. About that. So I went down the hill to the retreat centre because I knew, I thought I would go and I'll use the phone in the retreat centre. I didn't actually go. I thought, there's only one problem. I've just cooked a rather nice dinner. So I want to eat my dinner first. Right, I do want the dinner, because I do know that not eating isn't good for your brain. So I wanted my dinner, so I thought, well, when I've done that, I'll walk down to the retreat centre and use the phone there. And while I was having my dinner, I started to imagine the phone conversation I was going to have with Vidyamala in a minute, and what she was going to say to me. And I knew that because she's done this in the past for me, she'd say, "Oh, you poor thing, that sounds awful. Please don't lose heart. You know, you've made so much progress with this already over the years, and I've really watched you trying so hard on this. And it's not your fault. And, you know, your friends are here and we still love you, and you will get through this." And by this point, I'd just finished my dinner and I was about to go and make the phone call, but I realised that I wasn't at all unhappy anymore. I felt completely better. In fact, I could barely even remember what the problem was. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. It's certainly cheaper than therapy. Oh, this is incredible. So just the memory of a friend and what they would say could calm your brain down and you feel completely different. So anyway, it was quite funny. I did eventually get this therapy with a British National Health Service therapist, and in the area where I live, where I used to live in Manchester. Sorry, my notes are jumping about on the screen here. Just have to sort them out. There are lots and lots of Orthodox Jewish people living in my area, and actually, it turned out my psychologist, was an Orthodox Jew, and here she was, teaching me very carefully a system of therapy that was based explicitly on Buddhist principles. And we had this unspoken question. So if mindfulness and compassion are the two leading new treatments for anxiety and depression in health services in Britain, and I think also in Sweden, why is somebody who's been a Buddhist for the last 23 years still suffering from acute anxiety? And why does she have to be taught this by an Orthodox Jew? Okay. That's quite funny, isn't it? Life is very ironic. So we never really answered that question. I have a few thoughts on that. But I did find it extremely helpful to understand the brain science, or at least a simple model of the brain science, to understand what was happening in my brain when I was anxious and why. And I thought it was fascinating that the modern brain science could explain why it is that what the Buddha taught 2,600 years ago actually works. I mean, the Buddha, of course, taught from his own example, his own experience. He taught from his experience of what works. He put himself into situations of extreme terror in the jungle and then worked out what made him fearless. But I'm sure he didn't know why. So working out why, understanding why what he taught works, gave me so much more faith in my practice. And that in turn made my practice much more effective, I suppose because I had less undermining doubt. And then, of course, the whole thing was such a relief. It was such a relief to discover that it wasn't my fault. Because one of the things that happened was that every time this happened, I'd think, not only am I suffering, but I'm terrible as well. My suffering means I am terrible. So that's what the Buddha described as the second arrow. The first arrow is the suffering itself, and the second arrow is what you do to yourself and the way that you think about your suffering. So this, it's not my fault, it's the result of evolutionary development of the brain. I have a tricky brain. Everyone has a tricky brain. This is how the brain works. It's normal. It's not my fault. It's not my fault. This is how it is. So you could try saying that to yourself when you are in a state of deep suffering. Just talk to yourself. It's okay. It's not your fault. And then I also found it quite intellectually satisfying because, of course, I'm motivated to relieve my own suffering. Nobody wants to suffer. But also I could really engage with this as an ethical project, more generally. I came to Buddhism because of my interest in ethics, because of my ideals, my idealism. And I cared so much about finding a good and worthwhile and noble way to live. But of course the problem with that is that when you have such high ideals, the minute you notice you're not perfect, your tricky brain will come in and try and catch you out. Your inner critic will start up, but you're not good enough. You call yourself a Buddhist, you've got these high ideals, but look, you're not doing it. I know I'm not the only person in the room who thinks that. So this is what happened. Because of the way the brain works, looking back, I see that as soon as I started to practice meditation and Buddhism, I found these great ideals and I started to criticise myself even more than before. Because I'd set the goal a bit higher now, the bar a bit higher. So when I was writing the talk, I thought, well, so at this point, perhaps we should just give up on our ideals. Because it'd be so much easier, wouldn't it? Forget the recycling, don't worry about being vegan. Just drop it all, just go and eat chocolate. But that wouldn't satisfy me for very long. So we have our ideals. And then we also have these critical voices that come in, that sort of come along with them if we're not careful. So we could ask, what is the function of the critical voice? Because it's there for a reason, your critical voice. I'm sure it's very unlikely that anybody in the room doesn't have a critical voice. mine is trying to keep me out of trouble. It's saying, don't take any risks. Don't get anything wrong. If you don't get anything wrong, you'll never get into trouble. You'll never be criticised. And no one will ever make fun of you for failing. And you'll be safe from suffering. So it's quite... what's the word? I'm not looking for Swedish, I'm looking for English here. It's quite persuasive, I can really believe that. But actually it's completely wrong, because then you end up living in a more smaller and smaller, more enclosed life. So it takes courage to face your critical voice and do the opposite. And this is why we need to practice the metta bhavana. I've wondered for years why we need to practice the metta bhavana. I really hated the metta bhavana. Or practices very like the metta bhavana. Maybe not exactly as you were taught it, but there is a range of practices that are all to do with cultivating positive emotion. Positivity. And we can use them to make friends with our suffering. We can use them to make friends with the critical voice. And when we start to practice compassion, when we start to practice metta in contact with our, particularly with our suffering, that's what compassion is in Buddhism. Compassion is loving kindness when it comes into contact with suffering. When we start to practice compassion, it really involves facing up to our suffering, maybe for the first time. And it might be for the first time just because we've finally discovered it hidden underneath things like anxiety and depression and other habits we've unconsciously developed to protect ourselves from our suffering. Or it could be that the practice itself puts us in touch with deep pain. So if you are in deep pain, or any pain, don't lose faith in yourself. It's possible to make progress through this. You can reassure yourself that this is normal. It's human. It's common to everybody in this room. And facing this pain is what makes us more human. It makes us better able to help other people as well. And if you find that you are starting to practice compassion, but the pain is getting worse, that isn't surprising either. It's very, very common for the nasty little critical voice, particularly, to get very threatened by your progress and get even more critical for a while. In Buddhist terms, this is known as Mara. Mara is a sort of Buddhist equivalent of the devil. And I'm sorry to say this, but he's always described as he. There's no particular reason for that, but he is always described as he. Anyway, he gets very threatened and he gets even nastier for a while. So you may just have to send him some compassion and metta. So one of the things that I found when I was doing this compassion-focused therapy and really working on my compassion exercises, the kinds of things that Harvard Bodhi is teaching us, was that it was much easier to engage with these compassion exercises than it was with the metta bhavana. And I wondered why that was. I found it much more emotionally engaging and effective. I could really feel for my sad and frightened self. I could also really feel for the sufferings of others, far more easily than just wishing them well. So I found that karuna, the Buddhist word for compassion, was much easier to get in touch with than metta. In fact, I noticed that when people teach the metta bhavana, they very often don't just teach metta, they slip into, you know, being aware of the sufferings of others. You know, there's a bit of karuna in there as well. And I think that's because we naturally, well, I don't want to generalise from my own experience, but I think it feels much more natural to feel strong feelings for other people because I identify with this, because I sense and empathise with their suffering. So, and I said this to my psychologist, and she said, well, that's not at all surprising because, again, modern brain science tells us that when they put electrodes on the brain and work out which bits are doing what, apparently, considering with kindness the sufferings of oneself and others triggers a completely different set of neural responses from those that are triggered by simply dwelling on kindness and well-wishing. We didn't investigate this deeply. I'm not a brain scientist. but that's what she said.
Can you take that again, please?
That when we're cultivating feelings of kindness and appreciation and sympathy or empathy for suffering, apparently you can measure that in the body, the neural responses, the neural pathways, they work in a completely different way from when we're just thinking about loving kindness.
Okay.
Yeah?
Mm. In a stronger way? Or just
I don't
different?
Know. No. We didn't go into that. She just said that if you track things,
yeah,
something different happens in the brain. It's not the same. The brain recognises it differently, recognises those two things differently. But you'd have to do some more research. So those of you who are very experienced in the Triratna system of practice, we have a 5-stage system of practice. I'm not going to go into it, but if you know what I'm talking about, you'll be interested to know that I think all this would come under the heading of positive emotion, the general theme of developing positive emotion. If you don't know what I'm talking about, that's fine. So, and I'm saying that, but I suppose because it's important to embed this very firmly in Buddhism. This isn't a psychology weekend. You know. Well, it is a psychology weekend, and it's in a Buddhist retreat centre, and it's being taught by Buddhists. And you could say they're not different, but actually, in a way, they're different. So, the question is, yes, but is it Buddhism? Well, you know, first of all, I realise it's not my fault, this is just how it is. And once I noticed that what was going on and why, it did become my responsibility to care for myself. So there is a Buddhist ethical element in this. It did become my responsibility once I noticed it and understood it. It became my responsibility to do what I could to develop a habit of compassion. And it becomes my responsibility because the first precept is to cultivate loving kindness and avoid causing harm, and that is as much about yourself as it is about others. So the first ethical principle of Buddhism is to avoid causing harm, insofar as it's possible to avoid causing harm. And nobody else can do this for you. We have to practice ethics ourselves. People do terrible things in the world because they hate and mistrust themselves so much. And because they haven't realised it, or they have realised it, but they haven't done anything about it. So, that's our responsibility. And it's a Buddhist responsibility. So I was thinking about compassion as a form of generosity. And the Buddhist, or the traditional Indian word for generosity is dana, which is linked to the English word donation, to something you give, particularly money. So generosity is when you give things or time or your energy. You can give all sorts of things in life. And there are levels of generosity. In the early scriptures, the Buddha actually lists all the different ways in which one can practice generosity. Some of them are very expansive and highly developed, and some of them are really very basic. For example, you might decide to give things only to your best friend or your children, people you like, or because you think you'll get something back in return. Those things are not bad in themselves. We could just practice generosity at any level, that would be good, but they're very limited. And a higher form of generosity is just to give freely. Whether or not the person really deserves your generosity. You just give, maybe because giving is a quality that you value, and something which gives life meaning. And because you and all beings exist together on this planet, and you're all sharing this imperfect and wonderful life, you give maybe just because you wish to become more like a Buddha for the sake of all beings. And you realise that a Buddha is someone who is perfectly generous.
Can I ask a thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, yesterday in the talk we were discussing giving, and sometimes giving can make you feel drained out. Probably because you expect getting something back, but also it's really tricky when you give, not to give away your soul.
Yes.
Do you have any reflections or any?
Yeah.
I mean, how can you protect yourself?
I think you have to give only as far as you're ready to give, or maybe a little bit more. We don't want to become. We don't want to misjudge it. You can always do a little bit more. But I mean, a Buddha can give unlimitedly because a Buddha has gone beyond any sort of sense of limitations, or has transcended the whole difference between self and other. In fact, probably if you're a Buddha, there isn't even a concept of giving, because you wouldn't think of a difference between you and me. It's just flow. So it's effortless. So it would be ridiculous for us to think that we can give like that, because we're not enlightened. But we can always give. But probably when we burn out, it's because we've had these fantastic ideals and we've just gone a bit too far. Then we have to draw back, you know. So I think it's about balanced energy. And it's also about balancing care for self and other. You know, the first precept. When I notice people burning out, it's often because they have felt very idealistically that other was more important than self. It's not easy, though. I don't have an easy answer.
No.
But it's something like that.
Yeah.
You know. So how can we regard compassion as a form of generosity? Well, I would like to distinguish two important things, an important distinction between self-compassion and self-esteem. So distinguishing between self-compassion and self-esteem. Are you clear what those are in Swedish?
Esteem in Swedish.
What are they?
Självkänsla.
Can you say that more loudly?
Självkänsla,
självförtroende. Yeah. So, self-esteem, I think, is to think well of yourself, to wish yourself well because of the things you're proud of, the things that you like about your life. And I'm sure there are lots of those, and it's not a bad thing to do. In fact, when I first learnt the Metta Bhavana, I remember being told, well, you know, to sort of light the fire of your metta, you can think about the things about yourself that you're proud of, which is, you know, it's quite effective. But it is very conditional. I think that's the kind of psychological equivalent of the generosity where you only give to people you like. It's good, it's a good start, but it is limited. And any time you just don't feel good about yourself, you will not be able to do any kind of practice based on self-esteem, because you're not in touch with your good qualities. That's a bit like trying to do your emails when you're offline. There's no connection, is there? So, whereas self-compassion is, if you perfect it, if it's made perfect, it's unconditional. It's a care for your whole self. Your whole self as a suffering being, regardless of your faults, regardless of whether you like yourself or not, whether you feel proud of yourself or not today. Self-compassion is to care, is to feel for yourself as a whole human being, with all your strengths and your weaknesses, the things you're less sure of or sure of. However you're feeling today, you can practice self-compassion. So So self-esteem is very selective. It picks and chooses the bits of you that it likes. And you can obviously end up feeling worse. Self-compassion is integrating, because it welcomes the whole of you. It welcomes all your guilty secrets and your sadnesses and your losses and your grief. So here, if you are experienced in the Triratna system of practice, you'll recognise this as the stage of integration. It's very, very important that we gather the whole of ourselves as we progress in the Dharma. We gradually gather the whole of ourself and bring it all into our practice. So when you come to meditate, bring everything. Bring everything to your meditation seat. When you come to the shrine room, bring everything. Don't leave anything outside with the shoes. I mean, don't bring anything psychological or emotional outside with the shoes. The shoe rack is for shoes only. So it's this way that I think compassion is a form of generosity. It's a form of positive emotion, and it's an integrating practice. It's loving attention freely given, whether or not you deserve it. Whether or not you think you deserve it. But I mean, of course, seriously, you always deserve compassion. You always deserve compassion just because you exist. Just like all the other people in your metta bhavana deserve metta and compassion. Just for being alive. In fact, you don't even have to deserve it. You know, and we need it as well. It's interesting that generosity, dana, comes first in several lists of teachings that the Buddha gave. Various lists of heroic qualities to be developed by heroes, female and male heroes. I don't know how it is in Swedish, but heroine in English is not really the same as a hero. They describe different things. So be a hero. It comes first in the list of something called the six perfections to be cultivated by a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva is someone who has resolved to gain enlightenment for the sake of all beings. So
there are so many lists.
Yeah. There are so many lists. There are probably lots of lists because the Buddha wasn't any writing. So when people tried to remember what he had said, it was easier to make them into lists.
I get confused with all this.
So there's one list called the six perfections. There's another list called the ten perfections. But both of them, the first element is dana, generosity. So we could say that self-compassion, if you take it as a form of generosity, is a condition for enlightenment. It's something you need to develop if you wish to become enlightened. We need to become integrated. We need to become positive. So we need to develop self-compassion. So this isn't a side issue that some psychologist cooked up, right? This is core dharma.
So what was this about being a hero? Regards to six perfections.
Well, a bodhisattva cultivates six perfections, six wonderful things.
Yeah.
And the first of them is generosity.
Yes.
So generosity to yourself in the form of compassion. There's one element in that, you could say. I'm connecting up a few different things here.
So about being a hero.
I'm just saying that,
he
is a hero, she is a hero, we are also, we could say, aspiring or apprentice, training to be bodhisattvas. Bodhisattvas in training, yeah? So we also need to develop self-compassion. The Buddha also gave a list of four things called the four Sangrahavastus. You don't have to write all this down. The four Sangrahavastus, they are the four qualities to be developed by a bodhisattva because they bring people together. They create sangha. They create community. And the first one, again, is generosity. Generosity to oneself and others is a fundamental Buddhist quality. And you can think generously. It's not just about things you give. You can think generously. So compassion is about thinking generously. Part of it is thinking generously about yourself. It's so fundamental, this generosity. Sangharakshita once said that even if you can't manage anything else at all in your Dharma practice and you think you're the worst Buddhist ever, you can always practice generosity. Even if you wake up in the morning feeling absolutely terrible, hating yourself and everybody else, feeling miserable, just do something generous. Even if you don't feel like it, you could start by thinking a nice thought about yourself, even if you think it's not true. It could be an act of self-compassion. Or go and do something for somebody else. So before I moved to Sweden, I lived for many years in a community in Manchester. And one of the people in my community was an order member called Amitashuri. And Amitashuri has very serious, very, very serious health problems. And when I was at my worst sometimes in my anxiety, there were a few mornings when I woke up and I thought, I really don't think I can get out of bed. I feel completely awful. And I thought, it's not going to be good for me to stay in bed all morning. I thought, I know, I'll go and help Amitashuri. I'll go next door and find out if there's anything she needs. And she would be lying in bed in quite strong pain. And I would just go and knock on her door and say, what do you need? And she would be very moved because she spent a lot of her time in bed. And even very kind people sometimes get tired of helping people or just forget them. And if I hadn't been so miserable, I probably wouldn't have remembered her either. I'd have just gone to work or something. So I would go and get her some toast and some tea. And being very British, they'd have boiling hot tea, boiling hot toast. And take them to her. She was so grateful. Now and of course that built community because she felt loved, and I felt good about myself actually because I helped her. It was a great improvement on how I was feeling before I went round to her room. Now you could say, of course, that I just used her. Well, I did actually, in a way, I did use her, but it was good for her and it was definitely good for me. So, you know. It confirms both that compassion, it's active as well, it's very active. It builds community and it does make you feel better. So my final point is that it takes compassion takes courage. We do have to be heroes. It takes courage to face our suffering, to really accept it. And to take responsibility for doing something about it. It's not at all hard to understand why people start drinking or doing all sorts of other things, because it takes an enormous amount of courage to face suffering sometimes. There are plenty of ways that you can avoid your suffering. But all of you have decided to turn up on a retreat this weekend instead of taking to drugs and drink and all sorts of other habits. Or perhaps you've given up drugs and drink in the past and that's why you're here. But so, you know, you're already heroes. A very long time ago, a long time before I was ordained, I started to get very interested in the figure of Amoghasiddhi. So last night we encountered the archetypal figure of Avalokiteshvara, the one with all the hands and the arms and lots of heads, who embodies compassion. I was rather more interested in a green figure called Amoghasiddhi, who symbolises fearlessness. And he symbolises transformation and fearlessness and incredible unlimited energy for the good. And he also symbolises facing ultimate reality, which requires lots of heroic courage. And when I was ordained, well, when we're all ordained in this order, we take one of these figures to be a particular focus for our practice. So some people will take Mogacitti, some people take Avalokiteshvara, and a whole range of other figures, all with these qualities and symbolic colours and mantras, and it's very lively, imaginative practice. And we can meditate on those figures. And the thing that got me after my ordination was that I thought, well, it's great that I've adopted this figure of fearlessness, but now I'm getting in touch with my fear, and he doesn't seem to be very compassionate. He's not very cuddly. You know? he's really like this, and you need this, but I think, oh, but he doesn't seem to be very loving. And then more recently, as I started to do this compassion practice, I started to feel that more, and I also started to be interested in the fact that he also has a kind of symbolic consort. Don't know how to explain that exactly. A bit like his symbolic wife, you could say. Okay, she's called Green Tara. So she's also green, and Mogacitti is green. But she's his. She complements him. And she's a separate figure, but you often think about them together. And she symbolises fearless compassion. And so now in my meditation, it's rather interesting. I've sort of developed this rather interesting sort of rather unofficial kind of meditation where I visualise a Mogacitti and Green Tara together. She just appeared in this meditation. I've got my sad teenager self, who's probably where the anxiety started, sitting there meditating by a shrine. And then there's me at my best, my most mature, compassionate, fantastic person when I'm not doing my anxiety thing. And they're all sitting there together, meditating around the shrine. And they're all kind of taking care of the little teenager. So I think the more you start to work with these imaginatively, the more you can create all sorts of images for yourself that address whatever it is that's upsetting you. So be creative. That was my final point. Compassion takes courage and creativity, and it's a job for heroes. So dare you accept the challenge. Thank you. There are the books, so you can write them down, and the author.
Same author.
Yeah. Any questions or comments?
Thank you for sharing. It always feels good when you, because you're like ordinate, or what's it called? All the members, like, wow. You seem to, so it's always nice to know that you've been like.
Order members everyone. Freak out too.
Yeah.
Regularly.
There's hope.
I think order members are not really different from anybody else. They're just probably a bit more experienced and their commitment made a very particular public commitment to dealing with their stuff. It doesn't mean they haven't got any stuff. You can be ordained with stuff. You can all be ordained if you want to be.
I thought about this about altruism, about this question about giving and altruism. But I maybe wasn't totally clear yesterday that what you mentioned is that actually altruism, to be altruistic, as you're a very good example with Amishuri, that if you are truly altruistic, not truly, but if you're altruistic and sort of broaden your attention towards someone else and do something for that person, actually that makes yourself feel better. So I guess it's something distinguished that kind of altruism that makes yourself feel better than this we talked about yesterday a bit late. But then you sort of you stress yourself too far, or you do more than you had energy for, or whatever it is. But that is a very interesting thing about that, when you're sort of you're sort of caught up in your own suffering, you get very sort of self-focused like this, and that just creates more suffering. Mm. And if you manage to sort of broaden your awareness and look around and see the other people here, and then maybe I can do something, and then, as you said, then you feel much better. So mm. That's a good example of that.
Mm.
Altruism actually helps yourself also.
Mm. Actually, I can remember years ago when I first encountered Sri Ratna, I remember somebody telling me, you know, that Bhante has always taught that, you know, when you're in a bad state of mind, it's usually that your focus has become much too narrow.
Mm-hmm.
And Bhante is no psychologist, but he's just always saying your perspective has become much too tight, and just focus on relaxing your mind and your body, and just expand your perspective.
Or I was thinking, just, I mean, sometimes the pain is there, and the thing is to meet with self-compassion.
Mm.
And that's, I mean, that's, as you said, it's a way of being generous
mm.
towards yourself and to others, because then you release energy and you can get mm. off from that narrowed mental
mm.
state.
Mm.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's both ways.
Yeah, but that's what you talk about, isn't it? If you calm down a bit, then your perspective broadens and you can see more what other people do.
Mm.
It's very easy when you think about generosity as think about money,
mm.
but a lot of other things, like about your time and helping other people, listen, and a lot more things.
Yeah.
Telling your story.
Yeah. All sorts of things you can give. Don't let that stop you giving money, though, Krista. And the Buddhist Centre account number is... But also, money is just energy. That's the other thing I'd say. It makes all sorts of things possible, including conditions in which we can share ourselves and our time. And but yeah, quite right. Yeah.
Now, I was thinking about... I have found a way of thinking about asking for help, because I noticed that when someone asks me for help, I feel like thankful that they ask me. And I feel thankful that I am... able to help someone. So I've been trying to think that about when I need help, and I think, I don't want to disturb anyone, or I don't want to, you know. But it's the same way for them, probably. When I ask for help,
mm.
They might be thankful to help me.
Mm.
I give them the opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, you're an opportunity for them to develop generosity,
yeah.
which is going to help them move towards enlightenment. So it's win-win.
Yes, I think you can actually, we haven't talked about that, that it's about, you mentioned it a bit, when you start to develop compassion, self-compassion, you can realize that it's not so easy for you to actually to accept or to receive compassion.
Mm.
And actually there's also something of a generosity actually to also open up and receive compassion from yourself and others.
Mm.
And also to push it away. But that's not so easy, this
thing. Yes, that's a good point. If you can't receive anything from people, then you're closing down the opportunities for generosity in the world.
Yeah.
Generosity is only possible with someone who's willing to receive.
Mm.
We can use that as a protection, actually. Refusing to receive anything can become like a sort of shield.
I was thinking then that if you notice you have a problem of receiving, to me it seems that it's good to look at yourself. Maybe what you have to work on giving yourself self-compassion first.
Mm. Hmm.